It's 7:30 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Beth Voorhees. Kenneth Fink of Huntington enjoys visiting the synagogue in Beckley, his childhood temple.
Many synagogues over West Virginia in the recent years have closed and consolidated. But I think people here have a sense of hope that somehow they'll find a will and a way, and hopefully people will return or people will gravitate here. They make a great effort to try to keep the place going, and I'm proud of them. That's why I came tonight.
The story coming up on this West Virginia morning. Researchers involved in a taxpayer-funded independent water testing project in response to the January 9th spill by Freedom Industries began releasing findings earlier this week. The project, known as West Virginia Tap, is currently attempting to determine the odor threshold for the chemical in question, crude MCHM. They're also investigating the safety factors applied by the CDC in determining how much chemical can be in the water and still be called safe to drink. As Dave Mistich reports, researchers took time yesterday to answer questions about what they've learned and what their findings mean going forward.
Dr. Michael McGuire is conducting an odor analysis panels to determine at what levels crude MCHM can be smelled in water. Results released Monday from an expert panel put that number at 0.15 parts per billion. To put that result in a bit of perspective, consider that testing conducted by the National Guard could detect levels of the chemical down to 2 parts per billion, meaning the human nose has the ability to smell crude MCHM better than analytical testing methods currently allow.
It's pretty clear from some of the sampling and some of the anecdotal information that all of the water that got into the distribution system doesn't appear to be flushed out of the system or out of people's houses. And so people are still smelling water that was associated with the original chemical spill and the aftermath.
Dr. McGuire noted that while crude MCHM is no longer being introduced into West Virginia American Water's intake, there's little doubt the chemical is still lingering throughout the distribution system.
People, as I've noted, can smell this compound at very, very low levels. And so if they have not flushed out their houses, their housing premise, plumbing systems, if there are any dead zones in the distribution containing this old water, people will still be able to smell it. And so that's why it's obviously essential that a flushing program be conducted and be conducted thoroughly.
While McGuire is handling odor analysis for crude MCHM, Dr. Craig Adams of Utah State University's Water Research Laboratory has conducted a literature review of toxicological studies on the chemical. When asked about whether current data would or should allow for EPA regulation in regards to drinking water quality, Adams responded with the following.
With respect to the amount of data that was available for MCHM and the PPH and DIPPH, it's totally much, much less than would be available for a compound that they're making a regulatory determination. And the reason for that, I believe, is because these compounds would not commonly be expected to be found in drinking water.
Based on Adams's literature review, another expert panel will investigate whether the data available on the chemical was sufficient in the CDC's determination that the water was safe for use at levels of crude MCHM below 1 part per million. He also says exposure to the chemical in other ways, either by contact with skin or breathing, also needs to be considered.
Dermal exposure and inhalation exposure are two potentially important routes for any contaminant, as well as ingestion through drinking water and, frankly, food and so on. So they're important routes to consider. And the expert panel, this will be one of that we'll meet in late March and early April. This will be one of the key things that they will be considering, I believe.
As for the relationship between the black licorice odor of crude MCHM and potential health effects for those exposed to the chemical, Dr. McGuire is careful not to link the two quite yet.
There's not a direct relationship between, of course, odor and toxicity. For some compounds, you can smell it before it's bad for you, and for other compounds, it's the reverse. In this case, we have an early warning system of the human nose to be able to detect when MCHM, the crude MCHM, is present in the water.
Researchers involved in the WV TAP project plan to convene next week in Charleston to release in-home testing results from 10 homes sampled across the region by Dr. Andrew Welton of the University of South Alabama, a lead researcher on the project. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Dave Mistich in Charleston.
Over the past 2 days, 18 counties presented their facility needs to the State School Building Authority in Charleston. The requests totaled more than $100 million, but the agency only has about $45 million to give. That means some tough choices between deserving projects across the state. Ashton Mara has more about a few of those proposals, including one to upgrade the living quarters for a special population of students.
Again, I appreciate coming before this board again and presenting our project for Andrews Heights. This is our third time that we've come to the SBA for this project.
The second day of meetings started with a proposal by Kanawha County Superintendent Ron During. The county is asking for about $2 million to expand Andrew Heights Elementary in Tornado to get rid of four portable classrooms. The rooms pose health risks due to mold and safety issues when students have to walk outside to access the main building.
It will improve the quality of life for that community by offering preschool, by offering a place for people to have speech therapy, by giving them an actual computer lab, giving them space for art and music, for its continued growth out there in the Tornado area.
The county has $700,000 to commit to the project from reserves, but because the excess levy failed, Doreen says it will take the school building authority's help to complete the expansion of a school in an area experiencing growth. The growth in western Kanawha County is real, but may not be as rapid as what Monongalia County is experiencing. Superintendent Frank Devano says because of West Virginia University, a large health care system, and low unemployment rate, the area specifically around Morgantown is swiftly increasing, but in ways they aren't able to anticipate in the schools.
The elementary schools have restrictions in relationship to the number of students per classroom, so we can't overload the rooms, and so being able to have enough available rooms to be able to house our students is really, it's really a dilemma for us that we're trying to stay abreast of.
So with $5 million of their own funds and additional $10 million from the state, Mon County is proposing building a new Suncrest Elementary School to house about 520 pre-K through fifth graders.
In addition, the reconfigurations resulted in the closure of four inefficient buildings.
From expansion to consolidation, Mingo County is working to improve its facilities by shutting down some schools. Their proposal to the SBA: close Birch Elementary School by adding a $10 million addition to the current middle school building. Superintendent Randy Keefley is asking for $9.1 million in state funds to make that happen.
The current Birch Elementary School does not meet air quality standards, which result in teachers having to leave windows open to reduce CO2 levels in the classrooms. Electrical, plumbing, and flooring is difficult to repair or update due to asbestos. Students participating in physical education activities or recess on the playground have to move to the side for deliveries or other vehicles accessing the school. The playground and the driveway are one and the same at the elementary school.
This is the fourth time Keefley has applied for state funding for the project, with a bottom line that keeps increasing because of inflation. From new buildings to replacement sprinklers, the SBA has been asked to aid many school projects, but never before to build residential quarters for students. That's what Dr. Lynn Boyer is proposing at the Schools for the Deaf and Blind in Romney. A state-run school, there was some question if the SBA could even fund the project, but Executive Director Mark Manchin says there is no language in code specifically restricting them from doing so. So Boyer is asking for more than $7 million in aid to demolish a dilapidated cafeteria building on the Romney campus and build three residential cottages to house around 85 elementary age kids.
The residential component of our program is our weak link. We do not attract students, and we lose students because of our dormitory program. There are many aspects of that program: the facilities, the personnel, the food. Those are the main ones, and we are addressing them all. But without facilities to start, we will continue to be hampered in our goal of attracting students who need to be on our campus.
Boyer equated the school's current dormitory environment to institutional living, unsuitable for her students. Aside from these, there are other proposals. New heating, cooling, and electrical upgrades needed at five schools in Pocahontas County, the construction of two new schools in Wayne County, and roof replacements at six schools in Preston County, just to name a few. The SBA will meet again on April 28th in Charleston to decide how to spend their $45 million to best meet the needs of students across West Virginia. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Ashton Mara in Charleston.
This is West Virginia Morning at 7:40. Increasing cloudiness today, rain likely this afternoon. Temperatures in the 50s and 60s. Rain continues overnight with lows in the 30s. Partly cloudy tomorrow with highs in the 40s and 50s.
Support for West Virginia Public Radio is provided by State Electric Supply Company, your full-line electrical distributor. Online at stateelectric.com.
This morning, we begin a five-part series on West Virginia's Jewish community. Suzanne Higgins recently visited the small but devout congregation of Temple Beth El in Beckley. The synagogue will soon celebrate its 80th anniversary.
It's a small temple like a little small country church. We've gotten members from out of town that have come here from a bigger community, and they maybe stayed here 10 or 15 years. And one thing about every one of them tells me, or even somebody that just walks through the door for the first time, they'll say, you know, I feel as close to God here as I've ever felt in my life.
Sofer was once a teenager helping the rabbi at Temple Beth El in Beckley with maintenance and yard work. Decades later, he's president of Temple Beth El and still doing that maintenance and yard work. He tells us the small cinder block building, updated years later with a stucco exterior, was built in 1935.
At that time, there was a large group of Jewish people in Beckley, a lot of merchants, and they were conducting services like in people's homes. And they were also using a few churches around the area. And then they said, you know, maybe we need to put a temple together.
The town of Beckley donated the land for the construction of the building. Throughout the 20th century and into the new millennium, Judaism has clearly been a minority religion in the southern coal fields, and those numbers continue to decline. At its peak in the 1960s, there were 60 Jewish families in Beckley alone that were active congregants. Sofer estimates the temple now has about 30 families, and those are drawn from throughout the region.
Back in the 90s, when my kids were involved in Temple Beth El, there was a nice group of kids and parents that were very active in the temple, and we had Hanukkah parties and the high holidays. The temple was full of laughter and, you know, little footsteps running up and down the aisles and those type of things. And now in 2014, the kids have all grown up and they've gone their way. And not all of the parents come to temple on a regular basis, so.
Does that worry you?
Yes, it's concerning. But, you know, there is a core group of Jewish people in the community, and they really, really want it to work.
My name is Scott Gelman. I am the student rabbi at Temple Beth El in Beckley, and they are so excited to have me. And I am so excited to be here with them.
Scott Gelman is a second-year student at Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion in Cincinnati. He drives from Ohio once a month to lead this congregation in Sabbath services, education classes, and special events. Because membership has declined, Temple Beth El hasn't been able to afford a full-time rabbi since its last and beloved rabbi, Isidore Wien, died in 2000.
So this program really enables Judaism to continue thriving in small communities. I've had experience leading services in other realms, but to be the spiritual leader of this congregation, of this incredible community, is such an honor.
Gelman explains Temple Beth El is a Reformed synagogue, a denomination of Judaism that actively reaches out to be part of the greater community.
Our ties with the Jewish community and the greater community is really shown here on the Bima, which is the stage. We have an Israeli flag, and on the other side, we have an American flag, showing that we are truly have one foot in each community.
Also on the bima, or the stage, is the menorah, a seven-branch candelabra replicating what the Bible says was used in the Temple of Jerusalem. Also in this area, the lighted memorial boards, names of members of the synagogue who have passed away.
And actually, the synagogue does a very interesting thing that I have not seen in other synagogues. They have names of important people in the world who they feel have had an impact on the world, weren't necessarily part of the community here. But we have names like John F. Kennedy and actually Anwar Sadat as well.
And in the center, the Ark, representing the Ark of the Covenant, which the Israelites built in the desert when Moses came down with the tablets.
And so inside of the Ark, this community has two Torahs. Judaism today is not Torah law, but is extrapolations, and it is the original blueprint, but is not the blueprint for our living nowadays.
On this cold winter's evening, with the snow steadily falling, about 15 members of Temple Beth El listen to Rabbi Gelman link a recent Jewish holiday that celebrates nature with what he called the environmental tragedy of the chemical spill in the Elk River, and then ultimately with the temple's concern about its future.
Last week, we celebrated the holiday of Tu B'Shvat, and Tu B'Shvat specifically celebrates the New Year of Trees. So this new year of trees helps us to think about the environment and its ebbs and flows, but it is still easy to take for granted what we have, that is, until it's gone. We all learned how to not take the life source that comes out of the tap for granted. This building and its community are the lifeline of the Jewish community in Beckley. We must remember that this building stands and this community thrives because of those who never took it for granted.
The congregation celebrated this evening the birthday of 90-year-old Irene Fink, a member of one of the founding families of the temple.
My name is Irene Besso Fink. I came to Beckley in 1943. My husband, Sidney Fink, family of L.J. Fink. We had the Hub and Vogue, wonderful family store uptown, and a woman's specialty shop. It just has been a wonderful community. And there's no place like Beckley, West Virginia.
That's lovely. Let me ask you, what has Temple Beth El meant to you personally? Can you talk about what this building and everything that it stands for?
Anything that is good, progressive, honest, which is very difficult to come by, continuously growing. What we learned very, very young, what the good Lord taught us. Health, nature, beauty, honesty.
I'm Kenneth Fink. I'm actually a resident of Huntington, and I came up today to both because of the traditions in the temple and to honor my mom's birthday. Even though I'm from Huntington, I've kept in touch with what goes on here, and I was born and raised here and was bar mitzvahed here, in fact, many years ago. So I have fond memories standing in the sanctuary and see a lot of names on the memorial board that I knew. Members of this community have always been active in public issues and the growth of Beckley, and certainly the congregation has diminished in numbers. As you probably know, many synagogues over West Virginia in the recent years have closed and consolidated. But I think people here have a sense of hope that somehow they'll find a will and a way, and hopefully people will return or people will gravitate here. They make a great effort to try to keep the place going, and I'm proud of them. That's why I came tonight.
So this small congregation moves forward with the doors of the temple wide open. Temple Beth El is now readying for its yearly Holocaust Remembrance Day event, begun years ago by member Max Lewin of Beckley, who lost several members of his family in the Holocaust. Upon his death, Lewin bequeathed funds to carry on the annual public event.
This year we'll be talking about the righteous among the nations. Those who were not Jewish, those who were not the target of the Nazis of Germany, but helped Jews get out of Germany or other lands where the Nazis had taken over. The righteous among the nations is a category that holds great importance in the Jewish community when we speak about the Holocaust.
This Holocaust Remembrance Day event will be held April 27th at 1 in the afternoon at the University of Charleston Beckley campus. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Suzanne Higgins in Beckley.
West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. Support for our news bureaus comes from Shepherd University, West Virginia University, Marshall University, and Concord University. Our producer is Beneduccio. Our director is Teresa Wills. I'm Beth Voorhees.
Our series on the Jewish community is in tandem with The Story of the Jews by Simon Shama, March 25th and April 1st at 8 p.m. on West Virginia PBS. Funding is made possible by the Paul and Irma Milstein family, the Polonsky Foundation, the Pershing Square Foundation, the Joseph S. and Diane H. Steinberg Charitable Trust, James and Merrill Teesch, Mortimer B. Zuckerman, the David Berg Foundation, Daniel and Joanna S. Rose, and the Lindbergh Foundation. Support is also provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and PBS. For more information, visit pbs.org/storyofthejews.